Okay, we're going to start. So welcome back to everybody that's been with us for a few weeks and to any newcomers, welcome. This week's class is going to focus on the nature of Torah law. We're going to be asking the question, do all of the Torah's laws represent an eternal ideal? Or is it possible that some of Torah's laws are merely a concession to human frailties or to the realities of an imperfect society? Is the goal of Torah law, like the goal of some other law codes and the goal of some governments, to ensure the most efficient running of society? Or is Torah law fundamentally different? Is the goal of Torah, perhaps, when it releases laws, not just to tell us what to do or what not to do, but to convey values, to set not a required minimum, but the highest moral standard? I think that many people lean towards the second view of Torah. And because of that, though we might be comfortable with secular society, for example, looking at recreational drugs and recognizing that they're problematic, but nonetheless permitting them, we would say that Torah wouldn't do that. Anything that Torah permits or any law that Torah mandates, we assume has to be somewhat intrinsically positive, that Torah would never give over a law that tells us to do something that we might think is somehow problematic. We think that it has to be beneficial, whether religiously or spiritually, somehow making a person a better person. On this question, though, like so many questions in Judaism, whether Torah is an ideal or whether maybe some laws are not ideal, not all Jewish thinkers agree. And to just illustrate the concept, I think perhaps the most famous debate on the topic is the difference of opinion between the Rambam, Maimonides, and the Ramban, Nachmanides, on the question of sacrificial worship. It's a machloket, it's a dispute that I'm sure many people are very familiar with. So we're not going to go into it in tons of depth, but we have on one hand Ramban, who says that sacrificial worship is Hashem's ideal mode of worship. It's an amazing way to invite divine inspiration. And on the other hand, the Rambam says, no, this is not Hashem's preferred mode of worship at all. It's just a concession to the human needs of the time. We're going to look at this debate a little bit, mainly because I think any discussion of the issue of whether or not Torah represents an ideal has to include a discussion of this machloka, because almost every single thinker that follows the Rambam that wants to suggest that not all of Torah laws are an ideal points back to the Rambam in order to legitimate their opinion. So let's look at the machloka a little bit. I'm going to share my screen. We're not going to look at all the sources inside just for the interest of time, and because I think many people are familiar with this. But whoever wants to follow along in the text as I summarize, please feel free. Okay, so let me share the screen. So the Rambam in Mor Nebuchadnezzar, as we just mentioned, suggests that the sacrificial worship of God was not Hashem's preferred mode of service. For the Rambam, tefillah, prayer, is the way that we're really supposed to worship Hashem. And of course, then one has to ask, if so, then why did Hashem set up a sacrificial system? So the Rambam answered that this is simply a concession to the needs of the time, because the people who were living at the time of the Torah were accustomed to other nations worshiping their gods through sacrifices, and they couldn't fathom a different way of worship. For them, it was like so foreign that you would worship Hashem through thinking or through speech as opposed to through sacrifice. And so Hashem decides to meet the people where they are, knowing that people don't change overnight from one extreme to the other. He said, okay, if they need sacrificial worship, I'll give them sacrificial worship, but I'm going to kosher it. I'm going to make it kosher. Instead of sacrificing to idolatrous figures, they're going to sacrifice only to me. In addition, I'm going to use that sacrificial worship as a means of weaning them away from idolatrous practices altogether. And so Hashem suggests that we sacrifice specifically those animals which other nations viewed as gods, showing Am Yisrael that this is not a god, this is what we're sacrificing to the true God, and made certain laws such as the prohibition of accompanying a sacrifice with dvash, with honey, or with chametz, with leavened bread, because that was the way that others would sacrifice and worship to their gods. And in so, he was hoping that slowly the people would be weaned away and move away from idolatrous practices to the correct practice of worshiping Hashem. The obvious corollary of this idea, though, I think, is that if one suggests that this is not the ideal form and it's slowly moving someone away from the ideal form, what would we expect the Rambam to say is, and that at a different point in history, when the people were no longer feeling that they needed sacrificial worship in order to worship Hashem, at a point where they were no longer inclined to do idolatrous services, that maybe then there will no longer be sacrificial worship. So I think it's important to note that the Rambam himself does not say that. The Rambam does not say that in the future there will not be sacrificial service. In fact, he explicitly says the opposite. And I think this is really important because it highlights one of the tensions if someone takes this type of an approach. If you take this approach, on one hand, you're saying that the Torah is not ideal, but you want to maintain the concept that the Torah is still eternal. And so the Rambam's trying to have it both ways, saying that it's eternal and that this law won't change, even though he thinks that the law is not ideal and that it was meant to bring us to a different point. It also highlights, of course, one of the dangers in taking this approach. Because someone who takes this approach, of course, opens the door for other people to look at any law in Torah and say, oh, it was only relevant for a certain time. It might no longer be relevant. And of course, that's a very dangerous path to tread upon. Ramban reads the Mor Nebuchim, reads what the Rambam says, and is appalled. It's like, whoa, whoa, how could you possibly say that in his words? Right? These words are nonsense. How could you possibly say that the sacrificial service is just a reaction to or an imitation of idolatrous practices? After all, we have lots of people who are not living when there are other idolaters around, such as Cain and Hevel, or such as Noah, who go and bring sacrifices, and they're considered nishet reach nicholach l'Hashem. They're considered something that is pleasing to Hashem. That sacrificial worship is not Hashem's non-preferred way of worship. It's something that he finds pleasing. And even more important, he says, we have almost an entire book of Torah devoted to the laws of sacrificial worship. How could one possibly say that all those laws have no intrinsic benefit except to eradicate idolatrous practices? So the machloket that the Rambam and the Ramban have with regards to sacrificial service is a machloket that actually exists with regards to many, many other mitzvot as well. And what we're going to do in the rest of the shiur is look at a few examples of other mitzvot where people have this same debate, with some suggesting, no, if Torah law mandates it, somehow it must be ideal. And other people saying, no, this is simply a concession to human frailties, to the situation of the time, etc. And we're going to look at four basic areas. The first question is going to be the question that we raise with regards to korbanot. Can a law be mandated that even Hashem himself thinks is not the preferred mode of behavior? Perhaps with the intention of eventually getting to an ideal. Second question is to some extent the opposite. Is it possible that Hashem might have mandated a certain law, but later, due to changing circumstances, or perhaps due to an inferior morality that people have portrayed, an inability to stand up to that higher moral standard, that Hashem changes the law and replaces it with one that's less than ideal? So an example, one that we actually won't be looking at, is those people that suggest that originally Hashem had told the nations, everybody, that they should be vegetarian. And only with the Mabul does Hashem permit meat. with people suggesting, look, there's a change. The ideal might have been that we should all be vegetarian. Something happens around the time of the flood, whether it is that climate change and therefore there was a practical necessity to eat meat, or whether it's due to degraded morality and that Hashem can no longer hold people up to the standard of eating only vegetables, God changed and made a new law that you can eat meat. That's the second category. Third category is a question of, would Hashem ever perpetuate or act upon flawed or nonsensical beliefs? So to give you an example of what I mean outside of Torah, there are many, many parents who allow their children to believe in a tooth fairy. Okay, so why do they do that? Because it's somewhat traumatic for a little kid to lose their teeth. And so how do you soften it? But if you promise them that if they put their tooth under their pillow and in the morning they find some money or they find a little gift, all of a sudden losing your tooth is no longer traumatic. So a parent says, I'm going to allow them to believe in this little myth because somehow it's going to bring something good to them. It's going to help them. Other parents would be like, no, no, no. What's going to happen when the kid realizes that I was lying to them? How could I go and pretend that something's true when it's not true? And the question I'm asking, and many others ask, does Hashem ever do that also? Does Hashem allow tooth fairy myths for the people to believe in because somehow it's needed for them? It'll calm them down. It'll somehow help them out. Fourth area is slightly different, but I think still within this general realm of ideal versus non-ideal. Can laws simply be utilitarian? Meaning not that there's something problematic in the law, but there's also nothing spiritual or religious about the law. It's simply practical advice. So a famous example are those people that suggest that the reason for the laws of kashrut are because they have health benefits. Is that something that we should be thinking about? Like, are there lots of mitzvot that are just practical advice? Do this because it'll be good for you, not because it'll be spiritually good for you, but perhaps physically good for you or something similar. So those are the questions that we're going to be asking, looking at one basic example, maybe a couple for some of them, for each category. So we're going to start, and I'm going to share my screen, with the laws of slavery. This, I think, is a really important topic, because if one holds that Torah represents an ideal and that all of its laws are meant to convey values and have to be intrinsically positive, then how in the world is it possible that Hashem permits slavery? So let's look at the psukim inside. I'm going to share my screen. Okay. I'm going to share it from the psukim in our Torah. Okay, so we're opening to Perek Chaf Hei Vayikra. If you're looking on the source sheet, just follow down the next page of the source sheet. Okay, so the laws of slavery are found in several different places in Torah. We're going to be focusing on the laws of slavery of Canaanite slavery, as opposed to the laws of an evidivri of Hebrew slavery, because the Israelite slavery is probably a lot closer to what we might call indentured servitude than actual slavery. In that sense, much less problematic, I think, than the laws regarding Canaanite slavery. But the discussion of Canaanite slavery comes within the context of the laws of slavery for a Jew also in Perek Chaf Hei. And so we'll see some of the differences. So the psukim start, Pasuk Lamed Tet, V'chiya Much Achicha Imach, So this pasuk is talking about having a Hebrew slave. If your brother, right, a fellow Israelite, has grown destitute and is sold to you, you're not allowed to work him as a slave. You should rather treat him as a hired servant. You can't have him as a slave forever. He has to leave and is freed during the Jubilee year. Okay, there are a few more psukim about him. And then we contrast that with avadim that are taken from the lands around us. But if you take a male or female slave from the nations that are around you, from them you may buy a male or a female slave. And skip to Pasuk Mem Vav. You may take whoever you bought as a slave and make them an inheritance for your children after you. Okay? You're allowed to enslave them, but your brothers, B'nai Yisrael, you should not rule over with harshness. So here we see, to some extent, I think, three differences between the laws of Canaanite and Israelite slavery. First is, how do you become a slave? And this is why Israelite slavery is not considered, I think, exactly what we would normally call slavery. This pasuk tells you that when, or at least the way Chazal understands it, that if a person becomes poor, they can sell themselves into slavery because they would prefer to lose their liberty, but yet have room and board. Okay. And so Israelite slavery is not where you buy a slave that was, you know, a free man. It's someone who's selling themselves. Okay. Second, there's this discussion of how they have to leave at Yovel in the Jubilee year. You're not allowed to have a permanent slave if he's your brother, if he's a fellow Israelite. In contrast, though, a Canaanite slave can be inherited by your children, and according to some people, isn't just can be, but is inherited by your children and is a slave forever. And finally, this question of how you're supposed to treat your slaves, there seems to be a contrast between this emphasis of if you take a slave from Bnei Yisrael, lo tirdeh bo v'farech, you're not allowed to rule over him with harshness, implying perhaps that, well, maybe with your Canaanite slave, though, it's okay, okay? So the things aren't that simple, though, because this isn't the only place where we talk about laws of Canaanite slaves. In Shmot Chaf Aleph as well, we're told a few different laws. One of them is, if you smite your slave and he dies under your hand, you are surely to be avenged. In other words, even your Canaanite slave is not totally your property. You can't kill him and be held unaccountable. You are accountable for his death. More than that, if you knock out his eye or you knock out his tooth, he is set free. Okay, so these verses for sure show that it's, even though from Vayikra, you might have thought, oh, I'm glad I mistreat them. Here, obviously, it's not so clear that you can mistreat them. There's definitely laws legislating how one should treat their slaves. Okay? Whenever I read these psukim, for all the Americans in the audience, I'm reminded of a speech by Frederick Douglass. Frederick Douglass was an escaped slave in the American South. And once he escaped, he started to be a spokesman for the abolitionist movement in the 1800s. And he has a speech, which I didn't put on the source sheet, but in case anybody wants to follow along as I read, I'll share my screen and we can look at it, and we can look at it together. So in his speech, okay, one sec, let me just open that. Okay, he says, would you have me argue that man is entitled to liberty, that he's the rightful owner of his own body? You have already declared it. Must I argue the wrongfulness of slavery? There's not a man beneath the canopy of heaven who does not know that slavery is wrong for him. What, am I to argue that it's wrong to make men brutes, to rob them of their liberty, to work them without wages, to beat them with sticks, to flay their flesh with a lash, to sell them at auction, to sunder their families? Right? So Frederick Douglass here is arguing like, it's obvious why slavery is wrong. Do I have to explain to you that you can't just own somebody else's body? Do I have to explain to you that it's wrong to rob someone of their liberty, that you can work them without paying them, that you could beat them, etc.? And then he continues, what then remains to be argued? Is it that slavery is not divine? That God did not establish it? That our doctors of divinity are mistaken? There is blasphemy in the thought. That which is inhuman cannot be divine. And his last argument is, if you wanted to go and sanction slavery by saying that it's permitted by God, he says, how could you possibly see that? That which is inhuman cannot be divine. And we, of course, read this and say, but Torah did sanction slavery. Slavery is not banned by the Torah. So how are we supposed to understand that? And again, if Torah is an ideal, does that mean that if Hashem said that you're allowed to take a slave, that somehow God has no problem with that? Or are we supposed to come to the conclusion that this law recognizes the evils of slavery, but suggests that perhaps the evils of slavery is better than the alternative for some reason? So what we're going to now do is look at an array of mefarshim that discuss the topic. And perhaps not surprisingly, but I think very tellingly, all of the commentators that discuss our topic are modern, from the 1800s and up. Why is that? because our medievals have no problem with slavery. They're living at a time when this is a normative institution, and they're not bothered by it, right? The question doesn't come up for them. And I think that's a really important thing to think about. Questions that are burning issues for one generation are not necessarily burning issues for another. So in this case, until you get to when there are anti-slavery movements, many people actually just don't even raise the question. Okay? So we're going to look, starting with the Netziv, Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berliner, 19th century commentator, who's on the side of Torah represents an ideal, and if Torah tells me that I'm allowed to have a slave, that must mean that it's somehow a positive thing, a beneficial thing. So let's look inside. Let me just get that. Okay. So the Netziv said, and by
could we have the sources?
The sources, there's a link to the sources in the chat. Look at the second chat is a link to the sources. If you still can't find it, tell me. Did you find it?
Not yet.
Okay. Okay. In the meantime, it's on the screen. Okay. So the Netziv says, and he's someone on the extreme. He says, "Mehem tiknu mitzvah liknos dei behotiam meyovdei kochavim." The Netziv is somewhat unique here. He reads our pasuk not as you may buy a Canaanite slave, but rather it's a mitzvah liknos. It's a commandment to buy them. Why? So as to remove them from idolatry. So what's the Netziv referring to? So la halacha, if someone buys a Canaanite slave, the slave has to be tovel, has to immerse themselves in a mikvah, and he must reject idolatry and start to act as if he's a monotheist. And in addition, he's obligated in the same mitzvah that a woman is. So the Netziv says, the loss of liberty of a slave is justified because of the spiritual benefits he's going to be gaining by becoming a person who believes in monotheism and rejects idolatry. For the modern reader, I think many people might be uncomfortable with this notion. We think, what are you talking about? Just because I believe something doesn't mean I could go and impose my religious beliefs on another. But the Netziv is coming from a point of view where the Torah believes in Sheva Mitzvot B'nei Noach, and believes that one of those mitzvot is belief in God. And that if I could bring someone to belief in God, to a rejection of idolatry, that might justify a lot. Right? I just want to highlight something, that this concept that the, hold on a second, that I should, everyone can see my screen? Okay. So I wanted to just highlight that as far as I know, and I might be wrong, the Netziv is somewhat unique in reading this as a positive commandment. And Ala Torah, there's one way of accessing the various Monei HaMitzvot, meaning various rabbis that write books where they count what are the 613 mitzvot. So on every pasuk, if you access where it's right here, where you have a selection of commentators and you access Monei HaMitzvot, you get for every pasuk what the various Sifrei Mitzvot, the Rambam, Sefer HaMitzvot, the Smag, Sefer HaMitzvot, all these people who wrote books counting the 613 Mitzvot, whether or not they included the law that's mentioned as one of the 613 Mitzvot. And if you look at our pasuk that the Netziv was drawing on, Pasuk Mem Daled, over here, there's none of the Monei Mitzvot that counted as a Mitzvah. The Netziv didn't write a book of Mitzvot, so he wouldn't have been here anyway. But I think it's just important to highlight that he's definitely unique in viewing it as a commandment. Everyone else says this is permitted, but it's not a commandment, okay? But I think that the Netziv is definitely on that extreme, but he's definitely suggesting that this is something that's somehow beneficial to the person, because this person is going to be moving into a different religious space, and therefore the Torah permits it, and not just permits it, but commands it. Remember, according to him, though, this is limited to buying someone who's an idolater. If someone had already been a monotheist for him, it wouldn't work because there's no new gate. Okay. Rav Hirsch agrees, but for very different reasons, meaning he agrees that there's some benefit to the slave and that that's why the Torah commands us, but not a spiritual benefit, rather a physical benefit. So again, let's look inside. So Rav Hirsch says, Mikan shehatorah menicha, kigam ba'am shezeh atah yatsa mi'avdut l'chilut. Does the Torah assume, even a nation that had just moved from slavery to freedom, שימשיך להתקיים בקניין גוף ועבדים שנתנו בחוץ ארץ, that there's still going to be this, you know, institution of having bodily property and slaves that were brought abroad, brought abroad from Israel, to Israel. Says, how do we understand this? יהודי לא היה יכול להפוך אדם לעבד, רק בני אדם שהיו עבדים בהתאם למשפטם עם המקובל. So he limits the law, suggesting that there's only one type of a person that a Jew is allowed to buy, and that's a person who was already enslaved to another. In other words, a Jew is not allowed to buy a free Canaanite. He's only allowed to buy someone who had already been enslaved to others. And why is that? Havrato l'rechush Yehudi heita hatzalato hayechida shel ha'adam. He says, because this was the only way of saving that person. Meaning what? What Rav Hirsch is suggesting is that if you look, and this is probably true, at the way that other societies treated slaves, it was horrible. And we have, like, in the Code of Hammurabi, for example, you have discussion of what you're allowed to do to a slave. You know, much later we have discussions of things that people would be doing to their slaves, cutting off body parts for disobedience, you know, all that type of thing. And he says, and Torah law stands in stark contrast to that, so that the idea of a Jew taking someone who was a slave to another, not to a non-Jew, was really in order to save that person because of the humane treatment that they were going to be receiving at the hands of the Jew. Okay, so there's a very obvious question, I think, on Rav Hirsch. If this is the goal, then what should we have expected? We would expect then that after you go and buy the slave, you should redeem him, right? Wouldn't that be the best thing? Go and free him, right? That would seem to be the logical course of action. And Rav Hirsch doesn't say that you do that. In fact, the opposite is true. You're supposed to go and bequeath him to your son. He explains, הניסיונות המעציבים שימינו בארצות הברית מוכיחים מה אומלל ומופקר היה העבד, בין אם נשללו זכויותיו על ידי משפט המין המקובל, או בין אם הוענקו לו זכויות שוות, אך בעיני כולם הוא עדיין נראה כעבד.
So he says, he points to what's going on in the U.S. at the time, during his time period. And he says, you could see from, you know, history how trodden a slave was, even if they were already free. You can never remove the stamp of slavery, he suggests, from a person. Once a slave, he's always viewed as a slave in the eyes of others. And as a result, he's always treated in this really negative, horrible way. And so he says, Bayit HaYudi Hayalo Miklat. This is the only place that he'd get a refuge was in a Jewish home. Okay? So both the Netziv and Rav Hirsch, for different reasons, suggest that Torah law here is presenting something that isn't ideal for this person, either because of the spiritual benefits he's going to gain or because of the physical benefits he's going to gain. Okay? I'm going to actually skip the Rav Kook that I brought on this worksheet. The Rav Kook is quite complicated, and I only brought one piece of his position. One of the things that he adds to Rav Hirsch is that he suggests that in the world, there's always, even if not legal slavery, what he calls natural slavery, in the sense that the realities of life is that there's always rich and poor, and that there's always exploitation of the weak. And therefore, usually a slave is going to be better off than someone who is exploited by just plain old society, because there's nobody who's regulating society, and Torah law regulates slavery. Here too, one would ask, well, then why doesn't the Torah just regulate, you know, dealings between people that are free? Okay, so that's sort of crooked in real short. From there, though, I want to move to the other side. Many people, for obvious reasons, are somewhat uncomfortable with the Netziv and Rav Hirsch's reading of the text, and suggest that, well, maybe really slavery is not an ideal, that the Torah really never meant to think that slavery is something that is actively positive, but rather slavery is a concession. Right? And Nahal Moshe, a 19th century Italian commentator, says this explicitly. He points out first that Torah law is fairly humane in its dealings with slaves, but he says, but nonetheless, ilu hadur haya ra'oi, haitau seret legamre, lekno seret. He says, but if the generation was worthy, Torah would have completely forbid buying a slave. And many moderns go in this direction. Rabinovich, who was the Rosh Yeshiva of Male Adumim, of Birkat Moshe Yeshiva in Male Adumim, who recently passed away a couple of years ago, wrote an article called Dar Kavshal Torah, where he speaks a lot about ideal versus reality, etc. And he points out that Torah in general expresses this ideal of the fact that all men are created equal. Right? He said, and nonetheless, though, it recognizes this whole institution of slavery, and that seems to be an oxymoron. That seems to be a contradiction. And he says, how are we supposed to understand this? Says, we have to understand this concept that sometimes Hashem recognizes that we're in a place where we're not able to do what we're meant to do, that we're not at a high enough standard to be able to get to the first goal. And so Hashem meets us where we are, and that the realities of the time, the social and economic reasons, for social and economic reasons, and for the fact that slavery was normative at the time, it was impossible for the Jews at that point in history to give up the institution of slavery. And so what did Hashem decide to do? Vitra ha-Torah ayusuma ha-malei shali karomiyad. Yes, Hashem actually was forego the completion or the fulfillment of that principle of equality. And it decided that, I guess we're going to have to take this step by step. Society's not ready for it, but we're going to lead them towards it. And so it regulates the laws of slavery, even though it doesn't get rid of them totally. And Rav Rabinovich suggests that we should look at these laws to some extent, just like the laws of polygamy, divorce, and war, which are not ideal situations. But the Torah recognizes that circumstances are real. And sometimes those are the things that are necessary for the time. So too with slavery. I don't forget. Anyone that's interested in this topic, a really good starting point is an article by Rav Shmalo, which is called Orthodox Approaches to Biblical Slavery. If you just Google that, you'll be able to find it online. Who gives over a whole bunch of different approaches, some of which we just looked at right now, in a very easy and accessible way. So anyone that wants to explore further, I totally recommend that article. And I just want to end with one line from Rabbi Sacks, who suggests the challenge to which Torah legislation was an answer is how can one create a social structure in which of their own accord, people will eventually come to see slavery as wrong and freely choose to abandon it. What he's suggesting, I think, and this is, totally following in the lines of Rav Rabinovich and also the whole Moshe, is that in setting up the laws of slavery that the Torah did, first of all, in the way it sets up, Jewish slavery, where you're supposed to treat him as a hired hand, et cetera, and then even in the lesser ideal form of Canaanite slavery with its humane attitude towards slaves, what Hashem was trying to do is to slowly wean the people away from slavery altogether and showing them how to be humane, to recognize that your slave is a person, to recognize that you would never want to enslave your brother. People would have on their own accord eventually come to a place where they abandon slavery altogether. Right? So that's our first example. And as we saw, you have our spectrum. People are going to still try to say that this is an idea. Other people are going to say, no, this is a concession to human age.
Nima.
Yeah.
I just want to check very quickly. I had a cousin, unfortunately, she passed away, but she started the creative writing program at Bar-Ilan University, and her PhD thesis was called Biblically Enslaved. And she published it in a book. And she was showing how both sides of the Frederick Douglass is what made me think of it, how both sides use the text in the Bible to justify whether you can have slavery or you can't have slavery. So anybody who wants to delve more into that could look into that. Biblically Enslaved by Shane D. Rudolph.
Thank you. I'm sure that's fascinating. Okay, so that was our first question. Moving into our second question, is it possible that Torah might start with a law that's an ideal and then change it to in a less ideal form due again, either to circumstances or to human nature or something else? So the example we're going to look at is an example of the question of, I guess, centralization of worship. I think many of us, or anyone that spends a lot of time learning Sefer Dvarim, for example, assumes that the Torah views centralized worship as an ideal. Throughout Sefer Dvarim, there's like this refrain about Hamakom Asher Yibchar Hashem, the place that Hashem will choose, i.e. the Beit HaMikdash. And we're told you should bring your sacrifices to the Beit HaMikdash. You're not supposed to sacrifice wherever you want. Everyone's going to come to one place. And many of us assume that that's what Hashem always wants. The Ha'ol Moshe, though, suggests that maybe that wasn't the original plan. And his starting point is a verse in Sefer Shemot, and I'll share the screen so we can look at it inside. Okay. So in the Psukim, let me actually move that, hold on. Okay, so in the Psukim that are like right after the Aseret HaDibrot, we're given a command. Mizbeach adama ta'aseli, v'zavachta alav et olotacha v'et shlamecha v'et somcha v'et bikracha. You should make for me an earthen altar, and there you should bring all your different sacrifices. In every place that I will mention my name, I will come to you and I will bless you. Okay. So here we see a law that mandates building an earthen altar. And we have this pasuk, or half a pasuk, that seems to be somewhat in contrast to that pasuk that I had quoted beforehand of that. There's a makom asher b'char. Here it's b'chol ha-makom asher eskir et shmi, suggesting that there might be multiple places where Hashem mentions his name. Okay. But even more than that, we know from later in Torah, in Shmot Perak Chav Zayin, when we get the mitzvot of building the Mishkan, we're told, v'asita tamizbeach, right on the left side here, atzi shitim, chamesh amot orach v'chamesh amot rochav, ravu yeh. And then Vasite Karnotav al Arba Pinotav Mimen Tiene Karnotav V'Tipita Oto Nechoshet. When we learn about the Mizbeach that was going to be in the Mishkan, that Mizbeach is made out of acacia wood, and it's covered with Nechoshet. It is not an earthen altar. It is a brass altar. And the whole Moshe's starting point is, how am I supposed to reconcile these two psukim? How do they work together? And from there, he's going to move into the question of centralized worship. So there are some people who suggest that these two psukim actually are talking about the same exact thing. So look at Rashi on the pasuk. Mizbeach adama, sheya mimaleit chala mizbach hanachoshet adama bishat chaniyatan. He says that the mizbeach that is mentioned in Perek Chaf is identical to the mizbeach in Perek Chav Zayin. Both of them are really referring to the mizbach hanachoshet, to the brass altar. Just that we should know that when they traveled, they would fill it with earth. And so it can also be known as a Mizbach Adama. And so for Rashi, there's no difference between Shemot Chaf and Shemot Chaf Zayin. There was always a plan to have a Mishkan. And then Shemot Chaf, Hashem's already referring to the Mizbeach of the Mishkan. He's already referring to a Mizbeach that was going to be in a centralized place of worship. The Ha'ol Moshe says, no. We're actually talking about plan A and plan B. Shmot Chaf represents Hashem's idea, his first plan, what he wanted initially. Shmot Chaf Zayin is the bidiyavah. It's what happened secondarily due to some problem in the middle. So we'll read him inside, and then I'll give a little background to explain what he's saying. So he starts off with our question, how do we understand this pasuk versus that pasuk? And go to Ein Tema Badava right here. This, don't be surprised, there's no question. Kan kodem ma'aseh ha'egel, kan la'achar ma'aseh ha'egel. He says one law was the law that was instituted before we sinned with the golden calf. The second law was what happened post the golden calf. Okay, so this has to assume that the directives to build the Mishkan came out of written out of chronological order and happened after Chayta Ega. Okay, so he says something changed with Chayta Ega. Says, what was Hashem's original plan? How did He originally want us to worship Him? Says, Hodia Keli Barach Shemo. What was Hashem's original plan? Not that there would be one place of worship. Not that you would have just one group of people who are Kohanim who are going to be able to bring sacrifices. Not that there would be obligatory sacrifices, but that everyone who wanted to, whenever they wanted, wherever they wanted, to bring a sacrifice. That individual worship, decentralized worship, was actually Hashem's ideal. What changed? We messed up with Chayta Egel, and Hashem said, you can't handle it, right? I can't trust you anymore. And if I can't trust you, what do I have to do? I have to make a centralized place of worship with someone who's in charge, with obligatory sacrifices, etc. Okay. And so for him, centralization of worship, which becomes to, I think, many people today as being something which was so central to the way we think about worship of Hashem, he says, that's a b'diavad. That's not what the original plan was. And it's only because we couldn't handle what Hashem really wants. I want to see something similar. Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, the Kuzari, this comes out of what Rabbi Yehuda Halevi says. He actually doesn't say what I'm going to say explicitly, but I think he goes in the same general direction, noting that there's a change post Chayta Egel, and not just a change that we need a Mishkan as a kapara, as an atonement, but rather a change in Hashem's plan totally. Okay? So to understand what he implies, at least, one has to understand how Rabbi Yehuda Halevi understands the sin of the golden calf, right? Because we're saying that the sin is what made things change. The nature of the sin must be important. So many people suggest that the sin of the golden calf is pure idolatry. B'nai Yisrael worshipped this eagle, thinking that it was another god. Rabbi Yehuda Halevi says, no, that's actually not what Chayta Egel was. He says, B'nai Yisrael at the time, okay, were used to a mode of worship in which people would focus on a certain item, and through that item, think about a god. And he says, so B'nai Yisrael were mitzapim l'mashe yi'edot ha-moshe shi'ovid lehem inyan me'it Hashem shi'uoto v'ikabluhu asher ayu mabitim alav u'mapilim u'magadim oto u'mishtachavim nochacho l'elokim. Because B'nai Yisrael were waiting for Moshe to bring some object down from Har Sinai that they could look at, some concrete, tangible thing that they could use to focus their attention so as to serve Hashem. And what was that object supposed to be? Moshe was supposed to go up to Har Sinai and bring down the Luchot, right? And they were going to be in an Aron, and the Luchot were going to be this object, just like in Shul, someone might look at the Aron and think about Hashem. They would look at the Luchot and think about Hashem. What happened? Moshe tarries. He's up there for 40 days. The people don't know what's going on. They think he's never going to come back. And so what did they ask Aron? They ask Aron, could you make us some other tangible, concrete object that we could focus on? And not because they believed that that was Hashem, but they wanted to use that to be able to think about Hashem. And so he says, their sin was not lo yelach Elohim acherim, do not have other gods, because they weren't believing in another god, but lo tazelacha kol pesach. Their problem was wrong worship of Hashem, thinking that you're allowed to make an idol as long as you're using it to worship Hashem. So what's a change in plan? So he actually doesn't say this explicitly, but I think it comes out of what he's suggesting. It sounds like that according to him, it's very possible that the original plan was that we would have Luchot and an Aron, but no Mishkan, right? The people would go and look at the Luchot and they would use it as a focal point to get to Hashem. But what did B'nai Yisrael prove during Chayta Egel? That if you start off by looking at a certain concrete object, thinking about Hashem, all too often what happens along the way, you mistake that object not to be a focal point, but to be a deity in of itself. And so it's very possible that what happened afterwards is that Hashem realized, I can't just give them an Aron or Luchot, because they will soon start to worship the Luchot as a deity. So what does Hashem do instead? He says, let's put the Aron and Luchot in a Mishkan, where you'll still have a focal point, but it'll be so far removed from you that you're not going to start to worship the Luchot themselves. You're not going to start to worship the Aron, because there's this big Mishkan around it. So for him too, it's very possible that Bikfot Chet Ega, that after, in the aftermath of Chet Ega, that's what led to the Mishkan and this need for a Mishkan, not as atonement, because I don't think that's really a change in plan. Atonement is just a way of atoning, but because the first ideal plan that Hashem had, just to have Aron and Luchot, wasn't going to work anymore. And we needed to find a replacement for that. Okay? So that's a second example where some people suggest that yes, maybe sometimes there's a certain ideal that we don't live up to. And so Hashem has to move to a less than ideal form that we can handle or that will be better. With that, let's move into our third category. The idea that maybe Hashem sometimes allows false or superstitious even beliefs because somehow that might be helpful to the nation. So here, but like 2 to 3 small examples. Let me share the screen. Okay. So let's look for a second at a story that you're all familiar with. And Shmot Perak Yudbet, we all know this, how Bnei Yisrael were told to bring a Korban Pesach, and that after they shechted it, they're supposed to go and put the blood on their doorposts. And we're told that Hashem is going to go and pass through to plague the Egyptians. V'ra'a et hadam al hamashkol, and he'll see the blood on the lintel. U'pasach Hashem al ha-petach, and then Hashem will skip over the entrance. V'lo yitin ha-mashchit l'vo al-batech ha-megov, and he won't let the destroyer come into the houses. We have this mitzvah that we're all familiar with of putting the blood on the doorpost. But it's a mitzvah that's somewhat actually problematic, because the implication is that Hashem needs to know and see that blood in order to skip over your houses. But why would Hashem need to see the blood, right? Hashem doesn't need your blood in order to recognize that it's a Jewish house, which leads lots of different commentators to other understandings of this whole mitzvah. One, I think, well-known one is that Bnei Yisrael had to prove their loyalty to Hashem and the rejection of idolatry by sacrificing the animal that the Egyptians had worshipped and putting the blood of that animal on their doorpost. When Hashem sees their demonstration of loyalty, then they merit for him to pass over their house, or perhaps the Egyptians needed to see has been in your face defiant. Ibn Kathi suggests something totally different. Fascinating. He suggests that the people of the time, the masses of the time, had a belief that blood was apotropaic, meaning that blood could ward off evil, and had some special powers against anxiety and things like that. And he says Hashem knew that when he brought Makat B'chorot, Bnei Yisrael are going to be terrified. They're going to be hearing all the screams of the Egyptians dying, and they're going to be trembling in fear, and they're going to need to calm down. And since they believed that blood had this special property to ward off evil, if they put blood on their doorpost, it would calm them down. And he ends, "V'zem v'vor l'chachamim af lamon, yamidameh ya'aser v'shamim chazakim ba'adam im l'tovu l'ra." He says, and we know that sometimes even something's imaginary, if a person believes in it, it'll have an effect on them. Okay, so basically what Ibn Kathi is saying is that Hashem knows that blood on your doorpost does absolutely nothing, right? It's not going to ward off evil. It has no inherent properties to ward off evil, but because Bnei Yisrael think that it does, it has a placebo effect, and the placebo effect is real. If Bnei Yisrael really believe that it will ward off evil, it will calm them down. And so Hashem allows a totally mistaken notion and even makes a commandment, put blood on your doorpost, just because Bnei Yisrael believe in it, okay? Because it will calm them down, okay? And we might be like, that's crazy. What do you mean? Like, there's a whole mitzvah just because it'll calm them down? Like, why is that? But I think one thing that is important think about the mitzvot that we do, the dorot, the mitzvot of, that we do to commemorate the Pesach for future generations. So there's a Korban Pesach, and there's all sorts of things that we do to accompany it. But one thing that we don't do is we no longer smear blood on our doorposts, because that would play no role for us today, okay? According to Ibn, at least according to Ibn Kahn, okay? That's one example. Another quickie. Let me show the screen again. Is Shadal on the effects of the evil eye. Okay, so I'm going to do this quickly because otherwise we're going to run out of time. In Shmuel Perek Lamed, we're told that when we count B'nai Israel, each person has to give some type of a ransom for his soul, b'fkodatam, as Hashem counts them, the mitzvah of bringing a half shekel as part of our census. Why? V'lo yeh behem negif b'fkodatam, so that there shouldn't be a plague when we're counted. And Rashi there explains what type of a plague, that counting brings an eye in heart. Okay, somehow it brings upon us the evil eye. Now, Shaddad doesn't believe in the evil eye, but similar to Ibn Kasi, he says, B'nai Israel did, though, believe in an evil eye. Okay, and they thought that if you count things, or if you, you know, if you count your money, or if you count your soldiers, etc., that's going to bring an evil eye, and with the evil eye comes the catastrophe, and therefore, they're, you know, they're not going to count. What Shaddad suggests is, what's the real reason that counting brings catastrophe? He says, because counting leads to pride and arrogance, and arrogance comes before a fall. He says, often in history, what people saw was that someone who trusted in their own might, as, you know, I guess, you know, as demonstrated by the fact that they counted their soldiers and said, look how many soldiers I have, or they count their wealth and say, look how rich I am. Often that gava, often that arrogance leads to a fall. People didn't recognize that it was arrogance that led to a fall, and they attributed this whole thing to an evil eye. And Shaddad suggests that B'nai Yisrael believe in an evil eye, and that there's some inherent, you know, thing called an evil eye that will bring evil. Hashem knows that it doesn't exist, and nonetheless allows people to continue to think that because it's good for them. Says, why is it good for them? Because it leads them not to trust in themselves, and not trusting in yourself is a good thing. Okay, so here's another example where someone's suggesting totally false belief, but Hashem perpetuates it and allows for it because somehow it's going to bring some benefit. Okay, in this case, a spiritual benefit. Okay, one last example of this, which is way more radical. So in the ritual of the that we do during the Avodat Yom HaKippurim, we're told that we're supposed to bring two sivim. One is going to be LaHashem, two goats. One is for Hashem and one is for Azazel. The goat that's for Hashem is going to be brought as a sacrifice. The goat that's LaAzazel is going to stand alive and then be sent LaAzazel Hamidbar. Okay? And everybody questions, what in the world is Azazel? Why are we sending it a goat, etc.? And the whole Moshe suggests that the fact that Tanakh compares the Sa'ir LaHashem with a Sa'ir LaAzazel suggests that Azazel must also be a proper name. Just like Hashem is the name of a god, perhaps Azazel is the name of some type of a demon or some type of a, you know, god that people believe in, etc. Right? And then, of course, the question would be, why in the world is Hashem sending us a goat to a foreign being, right? That's normally us. Okay? So all Moshe says, Azazel doesn't exist. Okay? There's no such thing. Right? We don't believe in other gods. We don't believe in demons, at least, you know, for Moshe of them. And he says, Hashem thinks that that's total nonsense. But again, the people of the time did believe in that. And not only that, what did they believe about this demon Azazel? They believed that he might come to be mitameh the Mishkan, and that if the whole purpose of the ceremony of Yom HaKippurim was to be mitahir the Mishkan, was to go and purify the Mishkan from sins, etc. But they believe that there's this goat demon thing out there that could somehow sabotage the entire effort. They're going to be scared. And they want to send it something, a gift, to appease it. And the whole Moshe says, and Hashem allows that. Right? He says, Hashem recognizes the people have this fear. And this is extremely radical, because what's he saying that Hashem's allowing them to do? not just have this false belief, but do something that elsewhere is totally usur, is totally prohibited. And not only that, he's perpetuating the belief in demons and foreign gods. That's crazy, right? But the whole Moshe suggests that no, sometimes Hashem does things because of where the people are and what they need in order to get slowly to a better place. And he adds something which is really interesting. He says, Mi yodea, ma davar hore Moshe Rabbeinu ba'al peh l'nitziei ha'idah v'zikneha lehodia l'ba'im achareihem peitzchaleif matzav ha'uma ve'emunat ad. Says, and what we don't know is perhaps Moshe Rabbeinu had said out loud as a mesorah to be relayed orally to the leaders of his time that when the nation changes, this will no longer be necessary. Okay, so here the whole Moshe is extremely radical, suggesting that actually there might be mitzvot that Moshe relayed orally to the people, the leaders of the time, telling them when the people no longer need this, we should eradicate this law. Now, the whole Moshe doesn't himself eradicate any law. He's suggesting that it has to be something that was passed on orally, et cetera. Okay, and you know, you don't have freedom to just decide, but obviously he's going to the extreme of, yes, certain laws are total concessions to where the people were, and that there's even a possibility that they weren't meant to be forever. Okay, that's our third category. I have 2 minutes, and the last one, I'm just gonna raise the possibility. That's the question of, can laws be utilitarian? So we mentioned the idea of kashrut being instituted just for health reasons. Just another, a short example, the Ketoret. So in the description of the building of the Mishkan, the description of Mizbach HaKetoret, of the incense altar, isn't included with the description of the other vessels. It's described much later on in the chapters. And people question why. Why is it separate from everything else? So some people view the Ketoret as being one of the most special parts of the Mishkan, and saying that that's why it's last, like Acharon Acharon Chaviv, right? The last is the best. The Rambam and his Mor and Ruchim say, no, it's last because it has a very practical purpose. This is not one of the more, spiritual aspects of the Mishkan. He says, what's the role of the Ketoret? He says, Kasher hayu shochatim b'makom ha-migdash behemot rabot b'chol yom, ein safek she'ilu hayu menichim ato al zehenyan, hayar yichol kareach makomot ha-batar. He says, you have a lot of animals being sacrificed in the Mishkan, and it's going to be smelly. What's the role of the Ketoret? The role of the Ketoret is simply to be a deodorizer, to remove the bad smells of the sacrificial service in the Mishkan, and it's specifically inside because that's where obviously the smell is going to be the worst. So again, fascinating that the Rambam here is going to suggest that something that's in the Mishkan that we often, I think, tend to think, oh, must have some type of sublime purpose. He says, no, total practical. The Ketoret here is meant simply to make the mikdash smell beautiful, okay? And just so you should know, there are lots of other laws like that. Shemitah, he suggests, and one of the reasons he gives, at least, is that perhaps it's in order to help to reinvigorate the land so that it can be made fallow. Kilayim, again, people suggest maybe you're not allowed to sow different seeds in the same area because that's bad for the land, etc. Okay, so a bunch of different examples. So what we've seen, I think, is just how widespread this concept of that some laws might not represent an ideal, but might just be meeting people where they are, and that some laws might be just practical in nature. Some laws, perhaps we started off as an ideal, but then had to go to a place that was less than ideal, or maybe we started off less than ideal with the hope that societal change and we can move to a place which is an ideal. And to recognize that it's not just one mitzvah or two mitzvot that people have this machloket about, but lots and lots of mitzvot. But to also recognize the dangers in saying that. What does it mean about the eternal nature of Torah? What are the dangerous slopes of, well, if I could say that was only relevant or mainly relevant for one time, does that mean about, you know, knocking out whatever mitzvot I'm uncomfortable with, et cetera? So as we have like one more minute, just wanted to open up to questions, comments, or thoughts.
I have a question.
Sure.
First of all, mezuzah, we don't smear blood on the doorpost, but we do have a mezuzah on our door for generations. And the case we had in the time of David HaMelech, he took a census and there's a big plague. So obviously there was some harm that came about because of doing a census. It wasn't just an ayin hara.
Okay, so for sure. So let me, so Shaddad would totally agree that there's no such thing as an Ayin Hara. The census play came for him would be because David was arrogant and wanted to go and count his people. And that's the real reason. But the people at the time might have assumed that the reason was, oh, he counted and that brought an Ayin Hara, et cetera. Right. So for sure, I think, you know, what Shaddad was trying to say is that, of course, the real reason has nothing to do with Ayin Hara. That's just how people understood it and that Hashem allowed them to understand that. Wait, what was your first comment? Your other was about, oh, there's a lot of your response versus a mezuzah. So the truth is, I don't know if a mezuzah has anything to do with the story of Yitzhak. It's fine. Meaning I don't think those two mitzvot are connected.
I think they are. Because why would you have a thing on the doorpost that in the time of Karban Pesach and Yitzhak Mitzrayim, they have to put blood. So now instead of putting blood, have a mezuzah.
No, but in the Torah, when it talks about putting a mezuzah on your doorpost, it's saying this is supposed to be a reminder to keep the mitzvot as a whole. I'm not so sure that it's connected specifically to Yitzhak Mitzrayim. I think you're right that they're both on the doorpost and maybe there's some significance in that, but I'm not so sure that it's directly connected. I'd have to look, you know, I'd have to do more research to see if, and, you know, who connects them or not.
Well, thank you very much.
No problem. Okay. Other thoughts, questions? So everybody, thank you very much.
Thank
you. Next week will be the last class in the series, and I look forward to seeing everybody again there.